What is the greatest factor that determines success? Right. Is it your family background, where you were born, where you grew up? Maybe it's connections, you know, networking, who you know and who knows you. Or maybe it's IQ, your intelligence, or it's raw talent, physical ability. Or maybe it's your education or your training that makes all of the difference. In the Core 52 book, Mark Moore refers to the research done by psychologist Angela Duckworth. And it made me curious, so I looked her up, and I've been reading her book this week called Grit. She spent several years studying highly successful people in achievement-oriented fields as widely diverse as West Point graduates to award-winning authors to wine critics. And what Angela Duckworth discovered, it's not that those other things don't matter, but what makes the big difference, it isn't intelligence or wealth or education or race or background or any of these other demographic factors, right? But the biggest determining factor was, she said, quote, a combination of passion and perseverance that made high achievers special, right? It was their ability to endure for the long haul, a character trait that Duckworth calls grit. Let me share with you an example from her book. Chapter one talks about what it takes to graduate from West Point. Now, this is a process that begins in your junior year of high school. And you have to have a nomination from a member of Congress, a senator, or the vice president of the United States, all right? And there are 14,000 people who begin this process, but only 4,000 get this nomination. Now, out of those 4,000, only slightly more than half meet the very rigorous, not only academic standards West Point has, but also stringent physical standards. And out of that select group, only 1,200 are enrolled. Out of these 1,200 people who are admitted, 20% will drop out before they graduate. And many of those who do drop out do so in the first 7 weeks during a boot camp that is called Beast Barracks. Each day of Beast Barracks begins at 5 a.m. with an hour and a half of intense physical training. And this continues all day long with a constant rotation of formation, drills, training, classes, and workouts. It finally concludes at 10 p.m. with taps. All right, there's no weekends, there's no breaks, there's no outside contact. Now, the whole point of Beast Barracks is to determine who has grit and who doesn't. And for those who do, it's designed to help them gain even more grit. Now, I think the author of Hebrews would find a lot to agree with Angela Duckworth when it comes to grit. Our core passage this week, Hebrews 12, verses 1 and 2, is all about gaining grit in our spiritual lives, gaining grit in life. Right? Now, this is the second to the last week of Core 52, and it's the last week of 2020, a year that has tested our patience like no other, that has worn away our wherewithal. So how appropriate it is that we are going to focus on gaining grit. Now, the book of Hebrews is a bit of a mystery because we're not sure who wrote it. Unlike all of the other letters and books of the New Testament, no one has signed their name to this letter. Now, some scholars think it was the Apostle Paul, but the writing style is so different from Paul's letters. There's some internal evidence within Hebrews itself that suggests that whoever wrote it had to have been connected to Paul and to Timothy. And so some other possibilities are Apollos or the husband and wife team of Aquila and Priscilla.
What we do know from reading Hebrews, though, is it's a very Jewish book, right? The most Jewish book of the New Testament is written to Jewish Christians, most likely who live in Rome. Now, these Jewish Christians, they believe that Jesus is the Messiah, but they're having some problems leaving behind some of their Jewish ways of thinking and doing things. And so there's this temptation for them to give up on the faith, to quit the race, and just to go back to the old covenant. The whole point of Hebrews is this, that the new covenant is the fulfillment of everything hoped for in the old covenant, and that Jesus is superior to anything that the old covenant has to offer. And so what the author of Hebrews is saying is, don't give up. Don't go back. Stick with Jesus, because he is the finish line of our faith. Have enough grit to run the race and finish it. And here's what our core passage says, Hebrews 12, 1 and 2. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and every sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Our journey of faith, your journey of faith, is like a marathon race, the ultimate test of endurance, right? Following Jesus is a marathon, not a sprint. Gaining grit is about the long haul, not a 50-meter dash. It's not about how well you start. It's about how you finish. Now, this core passage gives us three things that we need to do to gain grit and finish strong in the marathon of faith, right? And then these three commands, they're bookended by two inspirational motivations. Inspirational motivation number one, look to those who ran before you. Look to those who ran before you. All right, see, the author of Hebrews, be it Paul or Priscilla or whomever, wants you to know that you can run the race because others have run it before you. Verse one opens with this motivation. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Now, this cloud of witnesses is to motivate us, but who's he talking about? Who are these witnesses? Oh, remember I've said before that whenever you see a therefore in the Bible, you need to find out what it is therefore. Well, therefore tells us that what is said here in our core passage in Hebrews 12 is based on what comes before. Now, Hebrews 11 is known as the Faith Hall of Fame, right? It's a virtual who's who of the Old Testament, right? Each one of the lives talked about in Hebrews 12 provides a vivid testimony of what is possible with faith in God. These are the heroes of the faith who overcame all sorts of challenges and failures to run the race. However, Hebrews 11 isn't filled with perfect people, right? They had flaws in their faith, right? Noah's drunkenness, Abraham's lying, Moses' murder, David's adultery, right? Yet they all ran the race. They endured. They didn't quit. And here's how chapter 11 summarizes their grit in verses 33 through 38. They conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, and stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness and became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back the dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with the sword, right? And you thought 2020 was tough. It goes on. They went about in the skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth, right? Those are the great cloud of witnesses, right? All of these people ran the race before you and they made it. They ran the race. They made it to the finish line. They endured. Now, why are they called witnesses? Well, first, their life offers testimony that it can be done, right? The race can be won and that God is faithful to the end. Picture Moses and Noah and Abraham and Deborah and Gideon and Esther and David and all of the prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and all the rest. And they're in heaven and they're looking at you saying, I made it, right? I made it and so can you. They're also witnesses in the sense that they are like this crowd in the stands cheering you on. They're watching as you run your race. Now, the finish line for ancient marathons was in the Panathenaic Stadium in Athens, Greece. And it held 50,000 people. It was like a modern stadium. All right, and they would all come to watch the end of the race and cheer as the runners crossed the finish line. And I think the author of Hebrews had that kind of a scene in mind when he says, we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. And he's picturing all these heroes of faith up in the stands, all right? And they're cheering you on as you run your race. And they're cheering, go, go. You can do it. You're almost there. All right, so when you've been knocked down and you don't think you can get back up, when you feel like giving up, when you're hurt way deep down and you don't think you can keep going, right, hear their voices. Listen to their cheers. Be encouraged. Stay strong. Keep running. And there are others in this crowd too. Others who went before you, maybe your grandparents, your mom, your dad, a friend who once shared their faith with you, a youth pastor who accepted you for you, a preacher who opened the Bible and helped you understand like never before. Right? Who else is in your stands cheering you on? Right? You need to know this because sometimes it feels like everyone is against you, right? You feel like you're in this all alone. There's no one on your side. Well, here's what you need to know from this motivation. You are not alone, right? The stands are filled with these faithful witnesses cheering you on. And picture all of them. They're in the heavenly grandstands looking down on you, rooting for you as you run the marathon of faith. Right? Now, after this inspirational motivation comes the first of three commands or instructions. And the first thing, if you want to finish well, is don't let anything slow you down. Don't let anything slow you down. Get rid of the things that encumber you on the journey. Here's what verse 1 says. It says, let us also lay aside every weight. Right? If it weighs you down, get rid of it. Because if it weighs you down, it'll slow you down. Now, remember that the author is comparing life and faith to a marathon race. Now, do you know how ancient runners competed in a marathon? Do you know what they wore? Nothing. They ran in the buff, au naturel, all right? Because the idea was they didn't want to wear anything that would weigh them down, that would get in the way. All right. So picture a runner in a marathon wearing, you know, bulky boots or decked out in jewelry like a rapper. All right. It's ridiculous. You wouldn't do that. You're not going to run a race that way. Now, the same holds true today, although we don't run naked, but we have the same kind of thinking because we have a greater, I guess, scientific understanding of what helps and what gets in the way. For instance, a runner might carry extra weights in training to build strength and muscle tone and endurance, but for the race, right, you get rid of every extra ounce that you can. Now, in cycling, which I like to do, they're called weight weenies. All right, these are riders who shave every gram of weight off their bikes as possible. And you can get road bicycles today that weigh as little as 13 pounds. All right, that's really nice when you're going up, you know, the hills here in the Ozarks. I remember when I moved from a bike that was like a steel bike and it weighed, you know, 30, 40 pounds, and I moved to a bike that weighed 15 pounds. All right, that was, talk about a breath of fresh air. It made all the difference. In the 2008 Olympics, 98% of the medals in swimming were won by swimmers that were wearing a state-of-the-art suit made by Speedo. Now, this swimsuit had been scientifically designed to get rid of everything that would slow a swimmer down, right? Waterproof material that repelled water. It actually changed the swimmer's shape to make them as sleek as possible. It added buoyancy so that more of their energy was directed toward forward momentum. And so record after record was smashed, and eventually the suits were banned because competitors claimed it gave the athletes an unfair advantage. Well, in the marathon of life, you want every advantage you can get. Now, there are some things in life that aren't wrong in and of themselves. It's not a sin. It's not immoral. They have their place in life. But sometimes we allow these things to weigh us down in the race, and they slow us down. All right, so, you know, imagine a runner who's running a race wearing these big over-the-ear Beats headphones. You like to listen to tunes while you run, but that's going to slow you down. Let me give you some examples. Sports, all right? It's good exercise. It's good for your physical health. It can even help with your mental health, all right? But what happens when sports becomes an obsession, right? When it becomes so important that it keeps us from worship, from fellowship, from spiritual growth, from serving, from pursuing God's best for our lives. A lot of hobbies and interests are like this, right? And they move from a very healthy place to something that Satan uses to distract us and to slow us down. And ultimately, he hopes to keep us from the finish line. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that hobbies and interests are bad, right? Even Jesus went fishing. God wants us to enjoy our lives here. I believe that life on earth is a gift from God. 1 Timothy 4:4 says, "For everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving." All right? But we've got to be careful that our enjoyment of things here on earth doesn't become an idol that weighs us down, that slows us down from reaching the finish line. Even legitimate concerns like family and careers, community service, right? These things are valuable and essential, but they can become big and bulky distractions that slow down your pursuit of God's best if they're not put in the proper priority. So what things are slowing down your progress in faith? Think about that. And get rid of the things that encumber you. If it slows you down, if it can keep you from reaching the finish line, all right, get rid of it. Is there some streamlining that needs to take place in your life? Something that you need to downsize or cast aside or just maybe move down the ladder of priorities. Don't let anything slow you down. All right, command number two, don't let anything trip you up. Don't let anything trip you up. Right? Picture a runner whose shoe has come untied. They trip over their shoelaces and are taken out of the race. And I was watching a video, a baseball video. It was Tim Tebow, and he was playing in the outfield for the New York Mets. And it was a routine fly ball. He's running in to make the catch. His shoe's untied, and he trips over his own shoestrings. And, of course, the ball hits the ground, and it's a base hit. We'll go back to verse 2. All right, after it tells us to lay aside every weight, it says, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely. All right, it's talking about things that might tangle you up and trip you up, you know, like your shoestrings. Right, these are the blatant sins and immoral habits that just flat out sabotage what God is doing in your life. And whether it's gluttony, gossip, an out of control temper, porn-fed lust, right? Every sin is a snare that is designed to trip you up and keep you from reaching the finish line. Even small sins, especially small sins. Now, Satan will try to convince you to underestimate the danger of every sin in your life, right? You'll rationalize it. It's no big deal, right? You'll defend, hey, everyone does it. But even the smallest sin has the potential to become a race-ending catastrophe. Every failure that causes a life of faith to crash and burn begins as a little sin, a small compromise, a slight indiscretion. Right? Every pastor whose ministry crashed on the rocks of a steamy affair, every ministry volunteer who's embezzled money from the ministry they serve, every child raised in the church only to question everything they were taught because dad couldn't control his temper or mom indebted the family up to their eyeballs. For every faith lost simply due to neglect, it all begins with some small sin that trips you up. Deal with sin while it is still a small thing. Sin must be destroyed because sin always grows and it will destroy you, right? Know this, you are not the exception and it can and will happen to you. All right, so number 3, the third command here, keep on running. Keep on running and don't stop. 1 foot in front of the other. The end of verse 1 says, let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Right? Don't just run, but run with endurance. Right? This is a steadfast, never give up, never give in persistence. It doesn't stop. If it gets knocked down, it gets back up again and keeps on running. Now we live in an on-demand insta culture that will constantly fight against your perseverance, right? Because we want our content, be it a video or music, in 30 seconds or less. We want our meals that we can make in 30 minutes or less. And we think that life change can happen in 30 days or less. I mean, just look at the popular diet books and exercise books. Yet we all know that doesn't work. Running the race with endurance is about persisting through the days that turn into weeks, that turn into years, that turn into decades, that turn into a lifetime. We're not very good at patient endurance. I read an article this last week that talked about how modern life and technology was rewiring our brains so that we have far less endurance than previous generations. Give some examples. According to the research, we lose our patience if water takes longer than 28 seconds to boil. If food that we've ordered at a restaurant takes longer than 14 minutes to arrive. If we send an important email, if it takes longer than 90 minutes to get an answer, right? If our phone dies, we don't want it to take more than 11 minutes of recharging before it'll turn back on. If we land on a plane, we don't want it to take more than 13 minutes to retrieve our luggage. And when we get in line, we will wait 30 seconds before switching to a line that we think is shorter or faster. Now, don't you think that all of this has some sort of impact on our spiritual lives? Oh, sure it does. Right? We lose our patience with our church family. We grow frustrated that God is taking so long to do whatever we think it is he should be doing. We wonder why spiritual growth doesn't happen faster. Right? We get angry when something doesn't go our way, and when we don't get what we want. And so this is destroying our ability to run the race with endurance. Let me give you the picture of someone who kept on running. These are some outtakes from the diary of John Wesley. He was a great preacher of the 1700s. He led a great revival in England. Now, early in his ministry, he was extremely unpopular. He was banned from many churches, but by the time he died, he was eulogized as the most beloved man in all of England. All right, so this starts in 1738. Entry number one, Sunday a.m., May 7th, preached in St. Lawrence's, was asked not to come back anymore. Sunday p.m., May 7th, preached at St. Catherine Cree's church. Deacon said, get out and stay out. Sunday a.m., May 14th, so a week later. Preached at St. Anne's, can't go back there either. Sunday afternoon, May 21st, week later. Preached at St. John's, kicked out again. Sunday evening, May 21st, preached at St. somebody else's, Bennett's maybe. Deacons called a special meeting and said I couldn't return. All right, so you get the picture there. He's had a very, very bad month. But fast forward 1 year, 1739, May. Entry number one, Tuesday, May 8th, afternoon service, preached in a pasture in Bath. 1,000 people came to hear me. Sunday, September 9th, preached to 10,000 people 3 weeks in a row in Moorfields. Wow. Incredible, isn't it? Now, nobody would have blamed Wesley if he would have quit in 1738. He would have been, it would have been perfectly understandable. But think of how much would have been lost if he didn't keep on running. So keep on running. Keep on running in your faith. Keep on running in your marriage. Keep on running with your children. Keep on running. Don't quit. Now, I want to end the sermon the same way the core passage ends, with a second inspiring motivation. As we run the race, our author says, look to Jesus, right? We run with endurance by, verse 2 says, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. And Jesus didn't just invent the race. He's the finish line, right? The word perfecter here means, quote, one who completes, to accomplish or finish. He ran the race, he won the race, and he shows us the way, and he is waiting for you at the finish line. You know, in a marathon, when you start running, you can't see the finish line. It is a long ways away. It's not around the next corner. It's not over the next rise. It is nowhere on the horizon. So it becomes very easy to lose mental focus of your destination. It's easy to get distracted by things that are much nearer at hand, all right? How much your calf muscles are aching, how nice it would be just to take a bit of a break and crack open a cold one, right? So you've got to keep your eyes on the prize. Got to stay heading for the finish line. It's easy for these distractions to get you off track. Now, I've never done a marathon, but I have done something called a century. All right, it's a 100-mile bike ride all in one go. Now, a lot of people begin a century. All right, there's this huge mass of cyclists that take off from the starting line, and it's a pretty wild bunch, really. Some of them are in costume. I mean, there are clowns, there are superheroes with capes, there are people carrying ET in a basket. Right, and you see some wild bikes too. Some of them have every accessory imaginable. Some of them are some really cool custom builds. And some of them are just simply pimped out in the most extravagant ways. Some of the writers bring these Bluetooth speakers that are blasting their favorite tunes, right? That is what it's like to be at the start-finish line of a bike ride. The finish line, however, that's a completely different story. Not near as many people cross that line. You see, some only go 10 or 20 miles and then spend the rest of their day drinking beer with their friends. Others drop out at 50 or 60 miles. Their bikes are just too weighed down to go any further, right? At the 100-mile mark, you don't see any costumes or any bikes festooned with festive decorations. You see only riders who are committed to finishing the race. They train for the long run. They only brought what would help them finish. They paced themselves and they persevered to the end. Now, the same thing happens from the journey, from the baptistry to burial, right? And if you are going to gain grit in the marathon of life, you have to keep your eyes on Jesus and keep heading for that finish line, knowing that there is a joy that awaits you there that far outweighs anything that we let go here. Thank you, and God bless.